O Lord, let us now hear what you want us to hear, so that we may be who you want us to be and do what you want us to do. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. Years ago, I had a dentist whom I would describe as a proud but uneasy atheist. I say he was proud because for him, his atheism, his refusal to believe, was a moral and intellectual achievement. Everybody else in the world may be swayed by that sentimental piety, but I'm too intellectually honest for that. I can stake out a bold alternative. But I also describe him as an uneasy atheist because he was restless with it. He was intrigued by faith. He was always curious and inquisitive about it. I mean, whenever I had an appointment, he knew I was a minister, and when I would get in the chair, he would start in on me. How can you possibly believe in God with so much evil and suffering in the world? Well, that's a good and big theological question, one of the biggest we can face, not easy to respond to, even when you don't have cotton balls in your mouth. But he didn't wait for an answer. He pressed it home more practically. How can there possibly be a God? If there is a God, why is there tooth decay, he would say. Now, I liked my dentist. Partly because I thought at some level he really wanted to be a person of faith. But he needed some evidence, you know? He needed something out there tangible that he could touch, that he could wrap his mind around, that would give him permission to believe, that would authorize his faith. And in that sense, he's not so different from the rest of us, I suspect. I mean, even the most faithful person here this morning, living the life of faith and keeping the faith is no easy matter in this kind of world, and it would be nice, wouldn't it, if we had some evidence, some terra firma on which we could rest our faith. That brief passage we just read a few minutes ago from Paul's letter to the Romans addresses this issue directly, I think. Certainly much better than anything I could have said in the dentist chair. But it is a hard and challenging word that Paul gives us about this. Because what he says essentially is, God is not present in the world as evidence. God is present in the world as the one who makes promises. God does not say, oh, look there, look over here. There's evidence, there's proof that I'm around, that I'm doing something. God instead enters into our life and says, despite all the evidence, there is coming a day when our swords will be beaten into plowshares and we will study war no more, I promise you. Contrary to what you see, every tear will be dried and death is swallowed up in victory. I promise you. Despite what your senses tell you, those who give up their life for my sake in the gospel are those who will save it. I promise you. Over against all the evidence, the way of the cross leads home. I promise you. Standing behind what Paul says, of course, is the old story of Abraham. It goes all the way back to the book of Genesis. He was called Abram back then. And Abram was an affluent, successful, proud, and important patriarch, blessed by God in many ways, but he lacked one thing. His wife Sarah was barren, and he had no child. And in the ancient Near East, if you didn't have a child, you didn't have an heir. And if you didn't have an heir, you didn't have a future. And Abram lamented loudly to God about this. I have no child. I have no child. My wife is barren. I have no child. So God took him outside and pointed up into the night sky and said, Abram, do you see that great river of stars floating across the heavens? You and Sarah will be the parents of more descendants than those stars. I promise you. And Abraham believed and trusted the promise of God. But the years wore on, year after year, year after barren and childless year, until Abram was 99 years old and his wife Sarah was 90. If it were today, they'd probably be in a nursing home, both of them, in wheelchairs with comforters over their laps and bottles of oxygen beside them. And into the nursing home comes God to say, Abram, do you remember that promise I made to you? Well, paint the nursery. Sarah's about to become pregnant. Yeah, laugh, because that's what Abraham did. And Sarah laughed too when she heard it. And when the laughter died down, Abraham believed and trusted the promise. Johannes Paterson, a biblical scholar many years ago, wrote a book on the geography of Israel. And in that book, he marveled that three of the world's great religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all come out of the same barren and desolate patch of real estate. Why, said Paterson? I think he said in part it is because the people who live there know the difference between brown and green. They know the difference between the desert that saps life and the lush oasis that gives life, between the burning heat of the desert sun and the cool taste of water and oil on the face. And all of the religions that have come out of that piece of real estate, he said, affirm that God plants the promise of life in the most unlikely and barren of places. God plants the seed of life in soil so poor that only God could make it grow. He plants the seed of life in the barren 90-year-old womb of Sarah. He plants the seed of hope with the children of Israel wandering in aimless sin in the wilderness saying, come, I'll take you to a land flowing with milk and honey. He points to a crucified rabbi on the cross and says, I'll raise him up and make him the source of life and health for all human beings. Even in a barren stretch of land like me and you, he plants the seed of life and hope, and on Easter raises Jesus from the dead to say, this is the way, this is the truth, this is the life, this is the future. I promise you. And though he was nearly 100 years old and his body was as good as dead and his wife was barren, he hoped against hope, and nothing made him waver in his trust of the promise of God. Many years ago, I worshiped in a Presbyterian church that was located right on a major university campus. It was a congregation that prided itself in its high intellectual life. There were a lot of university and seminary professors in the congregation. One Wednesday night, I happened to be at a family night supper, and I found myself seated next to a man I did not know. We struck up a conversation, and he said, you know, I don't think I've met you here at the church before. Have you been a member here long? And I said, no, we just moved here a few months ago. I said, what about you? Have you been a member very long? He said, oh, my Lord, I've been a member of this church all my life. In fact, I think I'm the last non-intellectual left in this congregation. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, I'm not. I haven't understood a sermon that's been preached here in 25 years. But then he said, you know, I'd never leave this church. Why? He told me that every Monday night, he and a few members of the congregation get in the church van and go to a youth prison. He said, sometimes we have a Bible study, but most of the time we just get to know the guys who are there and try to bring them some comfort and hope. I started doing that, he said, because it's the kind of thing I thought Christians ought to do. But I wouldn't miss a Monday night now because God is there and it nourishes my soul just as God promised. Then he paused and he said this very interesting thing. You know, he said, you cannot prove the promises of God in advance. But if you live them, they're true every one. You can't prove the promises of God in advance. But if you lean into them, if you live them, they're true every one. I think that's the best sermon that's been preached in that church in 25 years. Even though he was nearly 100 years old and his body was as good as dead and his wife was barren, he leaned into the promise and nothing made him waver in his trust. As one minister put it, faith is believing in the trust of God despite all the evidence and then standing back and in astonishment watching God change all the evidence. Maybe Bart put it better when he said, the promises of God are surrounded by things that contradict them. We are promised life in a culture of death. We are promised righteousness overwhelmed by our own sin. We are promised hope in a sea of despair. But faith boldly steps forward and says, nevertheless, I will trust every single word. Then reason begins to scream. The promises of God are absurd. The promises of God are silly. The promises of God are trivial. The promises of God are demonic. The promises of God are not to be trusted. But Bart said, faith is ready for that. And it says to reason, oh, blind and foolish guide, you understand nothing of the ways of God. And then faith reaches out and takes reason by the neck and chokes the beast, says Bart. Even though he was nearly 100 years old and his body was as good as dead, nothing made him waver in his trust. I love this story of the church that every Pentecost has Confirmation Sunday. What they do is they bring all of the young people who have been for nearly a year in confirmation class into their 11 o'clock service publicly to profess their faith in Jesus Christ. But in addition to their public profession of faith, they're allowed to do a little showing off of something they've learned in confirmation class. If they've been studying church history, they might tell a few facts. If they've been studying one of the creeds, they might teach a little of the creed to the congregation. 1 year, each of the confirmands had memorized a passage from Paul's letter to the Romans. They stood in a line in front of the church, and their teacher started. He said to the first kid, George, what shall separate you from the love of God? And George recited Romans 8. I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything in all creation shall separate me from the love of God in Jesus Christ my Lord. George beamed. His parents beamed. The teacher went to the next. Mary, what shall separate you from the love of God? She recited Romans 8. But as it moved down the line, the congregation grew anxious because at the end of the line was Rachel, a child of grace and easy smile, but a Down syndrome child. Could she memorize Romans 8? But the question finally got to her, Rachel, what shall separate you from the love of God? She smiled that familiar smile, and then she said just one word. Nothing. even though he was nearly 100 years old and his body was as good as dead, nothing made him waver from his trust in the promise. By the way, did Abraham and Sarah ever have any children? You are children of the promise, the children of faith. You're the children of Abraham and Sarah.